This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking up the issue of affirmative action this session in a case involving Michigan's ballot initiative in 2006 that banned race-conscious admissions criteria for college. This comes on the heels of the court's ruling in June in the case Fisher v. University of Texas about the use of race to achieve diversity on campus. Looking back over various court decisions, it's clear that justices, judges, and the public are divided over the value of and need for affirmative action, which has been around in one form or another for about 50 years. Our guest, Randall Kennedy, says he benefited from affirmative action as a student at a prep school at Princeton and then in law school at Yale. He's currently a law professor at Harvard Law School. His new book looks at the roots of affirmative action, explores the criticisms, and concludes that it's still needed. It's titled For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Randall Kennedy, it's been a couple of years, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
And talking about one of these boring books that you write about all the time, about issues of no consequence. Help us understand, and I think because it's such a misunderstood word, and I always hate to begin an interview with a definition, but when you talk about affirmative action, how do you define it?
I'm talking about any policy that prefers people associated with a given group. I'm talking about racial affirmative action, but you know, there's affirmative action comes in all sorts of guises. There's gender affirmative action. We have affirmative action for veterans in many states. So anytime that a private entity or a government reaches out a helping hand to try to advance the fortunes of a given group, that's where you have affirmative action.
And in the case of racial affirmative action, to right the wrongs of what? Discrimination, of racial inequality.
Well, affirmative action is justified along a lot of different, with respect to a lot of different rationales. So one rationale for justifying affirmative action is to try to rectify the mistreatment of the past. So past mistreatment has left scars that continue to debilitate people. And so one rationale for affirmative action is to help people along who have been hurt by past discrimination. Another rationale for affirmative action is to just speed the integration of society. So just suppose there are people, for instance, who've immigrated to the United States recently. They haven't been victims of past discrimination, but you might think that unless special efforts are made to bring them to the table, they'll be left on the outside. So integration can be a justification for affirmative action. Or a justification that people talk a lot about now with respect to higher education, diversity. The idea being that in order to have good decision-making, in order to have a rich intellectual environment, you need to have people from all sectors of society involved so that people can learn from one another's different experiences, different perspectives. So there are a wide array of justifications for affirmative action.
It has been described, and I think largely by critics, as a quota system, that it's the creation of, you know, we want these people in our university, in our business, because we need to satisfy some kind of a quota system.
Well, people often use quota as a scare word to make affirmative action seem rigid, to make it seem rather wooden. The fact of the matter is we do have certain quotas. So here's one of my favorite quotas. Ever since the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, there's always been at least one black person in a presidential cabinet. I don't think that's accidental. And that's true, too, with respect to presidents who said that they were against affirmative action. Ronald Reagan said he was against affirmative action, but Ronald Reagan always had at least one black person in the cabinet. George Bush said he was against affirmative action, but he always had one black person in the cabinet. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, a quota doesn't necessarily have to be bad. I would like to know more about it. I think that you can have intelligent quotas. I think you can have stupid quotas. I think you can have intelligent affirmative action. I think you can have stupid affirmative action.
You begin the book talking a bit about your own life and acknowledging the fact that you feel that you have been a beneficiary of affirmative action policies, whether it was going to St. Albans, a prep school, going to Princeton University, getting into Yale Law School.
Yes, I am an affirmative action baby, and I was a little bit worried about beginning the book on an autobiographical basis, but I thought that it would be important to put a face on affirmative action. And one of the reasons why I think it's important to do that is because affirmative action has been so vilified, it's been so stigmatized, that even some people who have been beneficiaries and like affirmative action get real defensive about it because they feel that their achievements are being somehow downgraded. If people say, well, you know, were you benefited by affirmative action? I think some people feel it to be almost an insult to be asked. So I thought, well, I have been benefited. There's no question but that I've been benefited. I'm a professor at Harvard Law School. I've been at Harvard Law School for 29 years. I was asked to come forward and put myself forward as a candidate to be a professor at Harvard Law School.
They sought you out.
They sought me out. That's very unusual. I was a good law student. I went to Yale Law School. I was a good law student, very good law student. Nonetheless, very unusual for an institution like Harvard to seek somebody out. Why was I sought out? I was sought out in large part because of the affirmative action ethos. They wanted to change the complexion of their faculty, and they took special steps to do that.
Well, one of the people that has criticized affirmative action is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, talking about the shame of affirmative action, feeling that it's damaging and dangerous, and feeling it's, as I read what he has said about it, is it somehow questions his credentials or puts his credentials in question.
Yes, Justice Thomas is the most vociferous critic of racial affirmative action on the Supreme Court. And he has said many times, that he feels that his own accomplishments have been degraded because people assume that he has been a beneficiary of affirmative action. The fact of the matter is, he has been a beneficiary of affirmative action. There's nobody in the United States who's been more of a beneficiary of affirmative action than Clarence Thomas. He does have a point, by the way.
I'm sure some people feel that way about him.
There is no doubt that there are people who feel that way. And there is, in my mind, there's no doubt that this is a cost of affirmative action. I think it's rather unavoidable. I'm sure that it affects me. When I begin my contracts class at Harvard Law School, I'm sure that there's some students in the audience. I have a class of 80 wonderful students. I'm sure on that very first day that there are some students who are thinking to themselves, who do I have before me? Do I have a real Harvard Law School professor before me? Or do I have a somewhat lesser affirmative action Harvard Law School professor before me? Well, that's a cost. And that's not the only cost that comes with affirmative action. There are others. But you always have to ask, you know, compared to what? Mm. In my view, the benefits of affirmative action far outweigh the costs.
Well, in fact, you even write in this book that you have seen students, probably in your classes at Harvard, that you feel are unprepared and perhaps are these affirmative action students that were brought into this elite university.
I think, first of all, at my law school and at many places, there is affirmative action. And sometimes you can have a situation in which you over-promote people. So, for instance, now in the affirmative action debate, there's a lot of talk about what some people call mismatch. Some critics of affirmative action say that in attempting to help, some students are over-promoted. They're admitted to institutions in which they will do poorly. And the argument is, if you didn't have affirmative action, these students would have gone to places more fitting with their preparation. Instead of going to the prestigious place where they're at the bottom of the class, they would have gone to a less prestigious place, but they would have been in the middle or maybe even at the top of the class. And in my view, affirmative action is like any other policy. We have to be careful. We have to be experimental. We have to be empirical. We have to see what's working, what's not. And if there is way over promotion, if people are being put into places where they're going to fail, well, no, that's not a good thing. But in my experience, that is not the way it's generally panned out. In my experience, institutions have been thoughtful. In my experience, affirmative action has been a useful way of desegregating elite institutions in America.
One of the critiques has been that affirmative action has been largely helpful to white women and to middle-class African Americans. It has helped a certain subset of the population, probably those that had some of the requisite skills that you need to make it at an elite university, for instance.
Yes, and that's especially if we're talking about higher education. That's true. So, I mean, if you're talking about affirmative action for a law school, affirmative action for a medical school, the people who are going to be beneficiaries are, of course, going to be in the sort of upper sectors of the population. I mean, if you're a beneficiary of affirmative action for law school, that means that you're a college graduate. You're doing pretty well. And there's some people who say, why should we be allocating attention to those folks instead of allocating attention to, let's say, the kid who doesn't graduate from high school or who graduates from high school but is still functionally illiterate? In my view, we have all sorts of problems in America. We need to be addressing inequity along a wide range of avenues, but we still have to be attentive to elite institutions. One point.
Go ahead.
The Supreme Court of the United States. Supreme Court of the United States, very powerful institution in American life. 9 people on the Supreme Court of the United States. All 9 went to 2 law schools. All 9 members of the Supreme Court of the United States went to either Harvard Law School or Yale Law School. That is, it seems to me, a vivid illustration of the importance of elite institutions, and it indicates why we have to be attentive to continuing to desegregate these institutions.
Well, we're almost up at a break here, but your book is called For Discrimination. I mean, the embedded in that is that affirmative action is good, a positive form of discrimination.
Yes. And I don't want to run away from that. It is a type of racial discrimination, but it is justifiable.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And I'm sure you want to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And Randall Kennedy, our guest, he's the Michael R. Klein Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, author of a new book, and as I just said, called For Discrimination, and it's subtitled Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independent Seaport Museum supports WHYY and will host its annual Old City Seaport Festival October 11th through 13th on Penn's Landing. Visitors can take deck or river tours aboard the tall ships or participate in the pirate battle on the Delaware. The festival also features live music, a craft village, and the Gosling's Dark and Stormy Tavern. The Pirate's Lair, sponsored by Metro Kids Magazine, features activities for kids. Information and tickets at phillyseaport.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the immigration debate in Phoenix is getting louder, with activists planning marches, threatening to shut down the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, all with massive rallies. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and if you're just joining us, Randall Kennedy is our guest. He tackles one of the country's more contentious issues in his new book titled For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. When you talk about, I guess, good discrimination, and that, of course, you know, taps into a whole host of issues. The idea that you can discriminate against people for, I guess, the greater good of the country, or to redress inequities or the horribleness of the past. But I think for the individual person that feels that they are being discriminated against, who said, "Look, I didn't own slaves. I didn't live in this country in the 19th century. I wasn't part of Jim Crow. Why should I sort of bear the brunt of this country's past?"
Yeah, this is what I say to the person who claims, the white person, let's say, who does not get into, let's say, the University of Texas and says, "Gosh, my record was better than this other person, a black person, who did get in. I'm the victim," the white person says, "of reverse discrimination." What do I say to that person? I say, listen, number one, can white people be discriminated against? Answer, yes. So if you show me a situation in which a school has excluded you or otherwise discriminated against you in order to put you down, in order to show that it thinks that you're inferior, in order to, if it's expressing racial animus against you, if it's doing anything against you because of your race, I'm against that. And I think that you have a good claim of reverse discrimination. That is not what is going on, however, in our institutions of higher education across the United States now. White people are not being excluded, are not being discriminated against because somebody's trying to put down white people. After all, in the last case, you know, Fisher versus the University of Texas,
right,
most of the students at the University of Texas are white. It is completely implausible to think that this predominantly white institution is excluding white people in order to put them down. What's happening is that white people are they being disadvantaged to some degree? Yeah, they are being disadvantaged to some degree. But the question is, why is their opportunity being limited to some small degree? It's being limited to some small degree for a purpose. What is that purpose? That purpose is to reach a helping hand out to racial minorities that for a long time have been oppressed in America.
Well, let me just stop you there, only because, again, in this, perhaps even going back to the Texas case or to cases of individuals, which is, yeah, absolutely discrimination of the past, slavery, Jim Crow. I mean, it's a long, long
And by the way, let me just break in. Not just, because I don't want to overemphasize, not just discrimination in the past. The fact of the matter is there is discrimination going on right now. We all know it. There is an invisible wind that faces people of color, and another justification of affirmative action is to counter that ongoing racial discrimination.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to get to, which is, I mean, I think it's perhaps harder to prove that kind of discrimination because in many ways it has gone underground. You could prove it when there were the poll taxes, for instance, but is it harder to prove the kind of discrimination that exists today and that makes it difficult to argue for affirmative action?
Well, two things. Number one, anybody who takes a realistic view of America knows that there's racial discrimination in every aspect of American life. People do tests all the time, audits all the time that show the presence of discrimination. Furthermore, with respect to every index of well-being in American life, it's quite clear that people of color get the shorter end of the stick, whether we're talking about employment, whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about the administration of criminal justice. A lot has changed in America, but the fact of the matter is the race line is still there. And my argument is, in order to deal with the race line, in order to continue our advance toward racial decency in America, we must continue to be race conscious.
Do you, though, imagine a day when we would not need affirmative action? I mean, probably not in our lifetime, but can you imagine a time when that when the history stays in the past and we have embraced new values?
Yes, I can imagine that. I mean, the past 50 years in America have seen remarkable change, and I could easily imagine a situation in which groups that are in need of help today are no longer in need of help. We've seen that with respect to various groups. You know, there was a time when, for instance, Asian Americans were just discriminated against, were the victims of invidious discrimination in the most terrible way. Now these groups are spoken of as the model minority. So things do change. I can imagine a time when, for instance, African Americans are no longer the main beneficiaries of racial affirmative action. It might be that there are other groups that need assistance. Fine. Do I think that that can happen? Yes, I think that that can happen.
What about the issue of class? And I'm thinking about, this is sort of a stereotype, but say Appalachia, mm-hmm. where you've got families where there has been endemic poverty over mm-hmm. the years, the loss of jobs, all the issues that are problems that come with that kind of a situation. Do they need a helping hand?
Absolutely. In the United States, we've got lots of poor, white, needy, desperately needy white folks, and we need definitely to reach out a helping hand to them. And I say this, though, let's supplement racial affirmative action with other interventions to help people. The fact of the matter is we have inequities of all sorts in America. We have class inequity, but class inequity is not the same as racial inequity. They often overlap, but these two things are distinct, and sometimes they need, and often they need distinctive ways of addressing them.
Because race is about identity, about who somebody is, and class is their station in life?
Well, I think that, they're the hidden injuries of class, and I think that they're hidden injuries of race. So, for instance, people sometimes say, well, look at this family. Look at this middle-class black family. They're in no need of assistance. Well, is that true? That's not taking into account the way in which they still face racial discrimination. That's not taking into account history. There are a lot of black families that their income may be middle class, but do they have an experience in the family with higher education? Maybe not. And those sorts of things have to be taken into account.
And that's Randall Kennedy, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called For Discrimination, and it's subtitled Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. And as we know, affirmative action has been in the news, it's been in the courts, and it's an issue that has touched a whole host of other issues over the last 50 years or so. And he's a professor of law at Harvard Law School. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Emily from Narberth to join us on Radio Times. Emily, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I am a high school teacher in Philadelphia School District, and I teach the topic of affirmative action when we're learning how to write essays of argument. And every year, this is a real hot-button issue, and it gets a very lively response from my students. And one of the things that comes up in conversations over and over again are two issues that you've already brought up. One is the issue of class and how socioeconomic distinctions put people at disadvantages. And the other thing that you brought up is the concept of the model minority.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm asking questions that are actually questions that my students have raised. One is, my Asian students oftentimes are worried that because they are seen as part of the model minority, in spite of the fact that their parents are immigrants, in spite of the fact that they are classified as low income, they're worried that when it comes down to their individual assessment getting into colleges, that their SAT scores are not going to be enough because Asian students are, some colleges report expecting higher scores for Asian students. The other thing
that first one only because I think it's an interesting one and it taps into some of what we've been talking about here. And Randall Kennedy, I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, my response is this. Because there's a lot of concern about this. Asian American students are, in some instances, disadvantaged by racial affirmative action that is really channeled towards blacks and Latinos. In my view, however, it really matters what the thinking is behind the disadvantage. I mean, if a group says they're just merely disadvantaged by a certain arrangement, I feel, I say, well, you're disadvantaged, but I don't think that gives you a cause for grievance. Let me give you an example. In 1988, the Congress of the United States passed a law in which the United States government apologized to Japanese Americans who were subjected to internment in World War II. And the Congress also provided for reparations for those who were put into these camps. Now, in providing for reparations, the United States government reached its hand into my pocket, through my tax dollars. I'm happy that the United States government paid those reparations, even though it's costing me. Was I alive during World War II? No. But I am a member of this polity, the United States of America, and I see it as part of my duty to deal with issues that confront us. Asian Americans are part of this community, and they should be called upon to do what they can do to help out with problems. And by the way, the Asian American community is also varied. There's some places where the Asian American community is doing quite well and therefore doesn't really get much of a boost, if at all, out of affirmative action. But in other parts of our country, there are Asian American communities that are, not doing so well, and they do get a boost out of affirmative action, and I think that's altogether proper.
But do you see affirmative action as a form of reparations?
I do. By the way, as a legal matter, with respect to higher education, the Supreme Court does not see affirmative action. The Supreme Court says that affirmative action cannot properly be based on some notion of compensatory justice or reparations. I think the Supreme Court is wrong on that, but that is our law.
But it seems the Supreme Court is focusing on this notion of diversity.
Yes.
That diversity is good for a campus, for instance. Sandra Day O'Connor was talking about that.
That's right. In fact, right now, that's probably the only justification, real justification that the Supreme Court will credit. So that in the argument last term with Fisher versus the University of Texas, all anybody talked about was diversity. One of the purposes of my book is to expand the conversation. I want other justifications to be part of the discussion.
Let me get back to our callers. Emily, thanks for the call. Let's see what Thomas from East, looks like East Norriton has to say. Thomas, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes. Hello. How
Hi.
Are you? I'm an adjunct professor of sociology at Drexel University, and this topic comes up a lot in my class as well. And I wanted to, and I always pose to them, which I wanted to pose to your speaker, that if we remove affirmative action, can we still be safe and see and show that there's not a institutional discrimination that's still existent or systemic in the system? Even if we remove that, can we still be sure that there's not a institution in a discriminatory manner, and that being systemic in our system. And I'll take the call, the answer off the air.
Thomas, thanks for the call. If a university removed affirmative action, would institutional discrimination still exist? Is there any way to know that?
Or? There's no way to know it, but I'd say two things. Number one, a justification for affirmative action is as a counter to subtle discrimination that we can't really get at directly, but we think is there. One way to counter that is to have affirmative action. So that's one point. A second point is we do know what has happened in places where affirmative action has been banned. So, you know, the people of California got rid of racial affirmative action, and we saw what happened. And what happened was there was a very sharp decline in the number of Latinos, the number of blacks, at the most elite public institutions of higher education in California. The same thing in Michigan, the same thing in other states. I think that this is quite concerning because our elite institutions have a lot of power and influence in American life.
Going back to the Texas case, though, Texas is unusual in that the University of Texas takes the top 10% of all the graduating high school classes in that state.
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting, sort of creative, unusual way to look at applications. Is that a way of saying, let's say you go to an all-black school, mm-hmm. your top 10%, you get into the University of Texas?
You know, that top 10% plan is called by many people race-neutral affirmative action or non-racial affirmative action. That is actually, in my view, just not true.
Really?
The reason why Texas passed the top 10% plan is because a federal court ruled that the University of Texas would no longer be able to take race into account. That was the Hopwood decision, 1996. Now, when that happened, the number of blacks, the number of Latinos, as everybody knew would happen, went down. And so the Texas legislature said, gosh, we can't have a situation where the number of blacks and the number of Latinos, the numbers have gone down so much and so quickly. Let's have this top 10% plan. They knew what would happen with the top 10% plan for the very reason you said. If you have the top 10% at, let's say, Robert E. Lee High School, you're going to have, white kids.
Right.
But if it's Booker T. Washington High School, you're going to have black kids, and so on and so forth. This was a clever way of bringing up the number of Latinos, the number of blacks, and by the way, the number of poor whites from rural areas. The poor whites in rural areas in Texas joined with urban blacks and Latinos to support this legislation. So in form, it's not racial, but right beneath the form is a race-conscious effort to continue with the task of desegregation.
We need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. That's Randall Kennedy, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's written a number of books. In fact, has been a guest on Radio Times talking about, I think, just about all of them. Mm-hmm. The new one is called For Discrimination, and it's subtitled Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we want to hear from you. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477 9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Chestnut Hill College supports WHYY. Learn about Chestnut Hill College's doctoral and master's degree programs during a School of Graduate Studies information session on Saturday, October 12th. More information online at chc.edu/visit.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents the Cape May Wine Festival, Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th, at the historic Cape May Lewis Ferry Terminal. 22 wineries will provide sampling of more than 300 locally produced wines. The festival, taking place from noon to 5 on both days, will also feature live music, crafts, and food. Full details for the Cape May Wine Festival at NewJerseyWines.com.
Going solo in the South.
We got to take care of our people. And man, what an opportunity this is giving me, and I'm not going to let it slip away. I'm seizing it.
Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear fighting an uphill battle in his own state to fully implement the Affordable Care Act. The politics of not taking no for an answer. Governor Beshear next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, The Economist, covering news and ideas that interconnect the world to give readers a worldview. On newsstands, in bookstores, at economist.com, or on smartphones and tablets.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Randall Kennedy about his new book. It's called For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. He looks at the roots of affirmative action. He explores some of the criticisms, and he does conclude that it is still needed. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You had talked about the importance of looking at our school system and the fact that so many promising young students get trapped in these schools where they don't get the education that they need and that they deserve. And this gets all sort of folded into this whole controversy about affirmative action. But it seems that's where we have to spend a lot of time and money and thinking to try to help youngsters who clearly can make it in the society and should be allowed to do that.
I agree. Listen, I'm for affirmative action, but I'm the first to say that affirmative action it's not a cure-all. It is by no means a cure-all. In my view, it's a rather modest intervention aimed at redistributing opportunity in American life. But there are lots of other things that need to be done. So we do need to spend a lot more attention on education at the earlier phases. So, frankly, people don't need affirmative action. Indeed, I would be willing to trade racial affirmative action in higher education. I would be willing to trade it away if somebody could say, Kennedy, I can guarantee you that every youngster in America has a excellent K-12 education. If I can give you that ironclad guarantee, would you give me and give up racial affirmative action? I'd take that deal in a minute. But, of course, that deal is not on the table.
Well, and sometimes we hear, and this would be, you know, not in all cases, obviously, but some black students saying they don't want to act white, you know, that being a good student for some students mm-hmm. is associating yourself with acting white.
Well, that's where I talk about the hidden injuries of race. The fact of the matter is, given our long, tragic history of racial oppression, it's no wonder that we encounter the educational gaps and other gaps that we confront. People who are against affirmative action say, well, you know, that's the past. They act as if Jim Crow segregation was something that happened, you know, in ancient history, the fall of ancient Carthage. Not so. I'm not that old, frankly. I'm 59 years old. I saw the end of Jim Crow segregation. I mean, I went into theaters where, you know, black people had to go into the side door. My siblings went to segregated schools. My mother went to segregated schools. The fact of the matter is there are millions of black people, millions, who directly suffered from segregation. And when you directly suffer from segregation, that means that your human capital was limited, and those limitations are passed on. So in the United States today, we have millions of people who bear the scars of mistreatment. And what I'm saying is that we need to address that mistreatment so that it does not continue to perpetuate itself.
Can we have, though, from your perspective, a kind of a one-size-fits-all affirmative action? I mean, it seems that it gets applied differently depending on an institution, depending on whether it's a workplace. I mean, it has many guises and forms.
Absolutely, and I think that's correct. We live in a huge country. The different regions, different histories, different institutions. What would be good for a small elite institution might be different from what would be good for a much larger institution that has a different mission. So I think that affirmative action should be decentralized. I think we should have an experimental attitude toward it. I think that, if people in a particular jurisdiction don't want to have it, they should be able to phase it out. I'm not saying that you have to have affirmative action. If you don't want it, you take a vote, it's phased out, okay. But it should be subject to local, regular politics. Courts should not be able to take affirmative action off the radar screen as a matter of sort of constitutional fiat. That's one of the central purpose. That's one of the central points I try to make in my book.
Which is that it's up to the people to vote?
Sure.
The courts stay out?
And the courts stay out, except if you can show invidious racial discrimination. So if there's a case in which you have white people who are being excluded by authorities who are trying to stick it to them because they're white, in that case, yeah, I want the courts to come in and to do away with that. Other than that, however, I want positive discrimination, sometimes called benign discrimination, to be allowed. Now, of course, there's some people who say, well, we can't distinguish between benign discrimination and malign discrimination, good discrimination and bad discrimination. Justice Clarence Thomas says it's all bad. Well, I think that he's wrong. There's a big difference between a sign that says, people of color welcome. That's sign number one. Sign number two says, people of color stay out. Both signs have racial distinctions in them. Both signs are talking about people of color. But there's a huge difference between those two signs.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Bill from West Hampton, New Jersey, joining us in Radio Times. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I detest discrimination in any form, any flavor. But the test that I use to determine whether something is discriminatory is simply the reverse rule. For example, if you said that could you give preferential treatment to a Caucasian person for entrance to a school, I would say no. Reverse that rule, say can you give preferential treatment for an African American, Asian, pick whatever flavor you like, the answer would also have to be no. So what's the solution? I don't believe it's affirmative action. It's admission requirements and selection. Any school, even and especially the elite schools, have one of the most gerrymandered, esoteric, hard-to-defend admission requirements for their schools. And that's where the discrimination takes place. Well, so what I would suggest is instead simply have a baseline for admissions. Everyone must be a high school graduate, certain GPA, certain range of courses. Once everyone has met that, all those people simply go into a hat or a lottery ping pong ball machine, and their number comes out. They're in the school.
Well,
no
Bill,
consideration of race or gender.
Fair enough. I'd be curious what you say in response, Randall Kennedy.
A couple things. Number one, the caller talked about sort of putting the racial shoe on the other foot. Let me give an example of where I would be perfectly at home with discrimination for a white person. Let's imagine that a white person wants to attend a historically black institution and applies. And as part of his application, he says, listen, I think that one thing that you all ought to take into account in the competition for a place at your school is that I'm white. And therefore, I can bring something to this school that yet another black candidate could not bring. I think that would be perfectly proper. I don't have any problem with whiteness being taken into account in that circumstance.
But what he's also saying is just, you know, you meet a certain criteria, you throw the names in the hat, you pull the names out of the hat. I mean, that doesn't, I don't know if that ever works because things are weighted, it seems. Did your father or mother graduate from university? That's counted as a positive for an applicant.
Right, but it seemed to me that the caller raised an interesting point. I mean, he said basically, let's do away with the engineering, and if you meet a certain minimal level, then let's randomize it, and then nobody can complain. Well, he has a point. On the other hand, I'm for engineering. I'm for taking positive steps to try to deal with the various sorts of inequities in American life. I would not feel good about leaving it to the vagaries of, essentially a lottery.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Brett has to say. Brett, joining us from Dresher. You're on Radio Times. Brett, go ahead.
Hello, yes. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I had an interesting article that I saw in National Geographic this month. It's a photo article that they've accumulated. Well, one of the articles in there was showing different faces of individuals and how they identified themselves. And the thing that struck me, and I don't even remember the exact details of the article, but the thing that struck me is that many of them were mixed race, and they were identifying themselves as one race versus the other. And so the question that I had for your guest there was, how does affirmative action play into blending of races moving forward, as I'm certain that we're going to be blending even more, like where we have a black Hispanic or white Hispanic or whatever, where you have an individual, depending on how they identify themselves, may or may not need affirmative action.
Well, that's an interesting... I appreciate it. It's interesting. Go ahead.
It is, and I think that the demographic makeup of the United States is changing, and it will, I think, over time in the future, pose new problems. Right now, however, I think it's not all that big of a problem. The way it works now generally at institutions, people check a box, and we really have an honor system. Institutions do not police the checking of the box, and I think that's a good thing. Frankly, if we did police sharply, closely, the checking of the box, that would really raise the costs of affirmative action and, in fact, might very well imperil it, because I think a lot of people would be very uncomfortable with, let's say, the government coming in and saying, gosh, you checked the box, we're taking a look at your picture. We don't think that you say that you're black, but we don't think that you're black enough to count as black. That sort of regime would be one, I think, that a lot of people would rebel against and probably rebel against appropriately.
Brett, thanks for the call. Let me see what John from Collingswood has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, as usual, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to point out that Eleanor Holmes Norton, the original chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, famously said, it would have been, I don't know, early 80s, late 70s when she was invested in that position, at some point, some generation is going to, quote, bite the bullet regarding 400 years of discrimination. And forgive me, let me just rock it along here. When the gentleman spoke of being phased out in the event of a particular point of view, he spoke of invidious discrimination regarding preferential treatment without demonstrating overt discrimination. Well, I mean, that's a point of view worth considering, but doesn't that invite a negative interpretation? It just seems risky.
Not sure I entirely understand what you're saying, John, but let me see if our guest does.
Well, I think that the caller is raising a point that people are talking about, and that is, what is the end point? What is the horizon? So, for instance, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in the Grutter versus the University of Michigan talked about there being a 25-year sunset on affirmative action. And, you know, in my classes, we often talk about, well, when should this end? I'm not sure when it should end. I think I'm loath to present, to posit a formula. One formula that comes to mind is this, and when I say this, it suggests how much I think this issue is going to remain with us for a long time. I could imagine someone saying, well, we won't need any more racial affirmative action when you can go to a hospital and when you have all the newborns there, when you are unable to take a look at the race of a newborn and make some confident predictions about risk, when you're unable to take a look at a white baby and a black baby and say, well, based on race, the risk of this person ending up in prison is such and such, the risk of, or the likelihood of this person being a CEO, the likelihood of this person being a doctor, when race has withered away as a strong predictive factor, then we can do away with affirmative action. I think that, frankly, I can imagine that day happening. I won't be around to see it, however.
Well, and we almost have we have just a minute before we have to say goodbye, but are you talking about the sort of unconscious stereotyping or sort of racial designations or something much more conscious than that?
I'm talking about the continuing grip of the past. I'm talking about fresh racial discrimination. I'm talking about all of the ways in which the race line continues to have a strong influence on the fate of individuals. At this moment, it does have a strong influence on the fate of individuals. Hopefully in the future, it will have less influence.
Well, Randall Kennedy, always a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And the book is called For Discrimination, and it's subtitled Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. He is the Michael R. Klein Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, the author of a number of books, including Race, Crime, and the Law, Sellout, The Politics of Racial Betrayal, Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, and Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, much there for you to check out. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. Thanks so much for joining us.